Welcome to a Friday edition of the Exploring Mining Podcast. We are finishing the week off right with one of my favorite experts to chat with, Peter Kraut. This week, we follow up after a great run in gold, and Peter gives his forecast for the spring and talks about key indicators to pay attention to. In his latest presentation, he calls for silver to be the next uranium. We talk about PDAC, follow up from our last podcast on Bolivia and some of the key players. We also speak about two great silver juniors in Nevada. If you haven't already, go follow Peter on Twitter and check out his investment newsletter, Silver Stock Investor, at www.silverstockinvestor.com. You can also buy his book, The Great Silver Bull, back in the top three on Amazon.com. This podcast may contain forward-looking statements, and investors are reminded to do their own due diligence. Enjoy the show. Peter, thanks so much for joining us on the show again. And congrats on your book being in the top three on Amazon again. I'm hoping it's a sign of the times for a bull market. Just curious, as we just finished up PDAC, what some of your feedback was from boots on the ground of the silver investors and silver juniors out there.
Yeah. So, well, thank you for that, Callie. It's always a pleasure to chat with you, and I appreciate the time once again. So, yes, recently back, fresh off of PDAC, and got to say, what helped was gold really kind of seemed to have kicked into high gear Friday prior to PDAC starting, and then it's been pretty much almost continuously higher. We've got, you know, a little bit of pullback last day or two. So many of us have been through this so many times before. So yeah, a lot of the participants, I guess I'm going to say they're maybe a little bit jaded, but still. It's really interesting. When I wrote my last update, I said maybe for once this time around the PDAC curse has switched into reverse, and so maybe it's the PDAC reverse, and because normally you don't get this, you get the opposite reaction, especially in precious metals. And so gold's been very strong, silver has followed, I'm going to say, considerably. Obviously, silver is nowhere near all-time highs like gold is, but we have seen a considerable move in silver, and it has given, I'm going to say, renewed rejuvenation, a little bit of renewed rejuvenation to the sector. You know, the stocks, the silver stocks, I'm going to say in particular, are so beaten down. There is a quote that I have, and it was in fact in one of my recent presentations from Rick Rule, and Rick is very, very bullish on silver right now, and he said the silver equity market resembles that of uranium in 2022. It's stupidly cheap. So I mean, I completely concur with that, and for one, that's one of the reasons that I titled my recent presentation, Silver is the New Oil and the Next Uranium, because if you look at what uranium's done in the past sort of 6 to 8 months, it's more than doubled in price. And I think that silver at some point is certainly set to have that kind of a run.
Since you mentioned gold with the run right now, I mean, there's a little bit of a pullback, but can you just talk to our following a little bit of some of the impact of the macros that you're seeing, and, you know, what you forecast maybe for the next 30 days or 60 days?
It's obviously always tougher when it's really short term. I will say that if you look at the latest consumer price index, so the inflation numbers out of the U.S., they were up 3.2% for February on the year, which was higher than January's 3.1, and it was actually a surprise. So inflation is not dead. It's certainly with us, and it does not seem to be slowing quite like the Fed would like it to. Obviously, their target, their stated target for almost forever has been 2%. And so we're still well off from that. We're still more than 50% above. And yet Powell's comments recently provided some support to the markets, because the regular indices, the broader indices rallied despite the CPI numbers, and it's almost like they're disregarding them. And they're saying, well, okay, at worst, the Fed's going to hold a little bit longer, you know, at current levels before they start cutting. I'm actually surprised that the market seemed to have gotten a lot ahead of itself. They were pricing in potentially the first cut around March, and it just never felt like that was realistic to me. I always felt like mid-year at the soonest. I still kind of think that's likely to be the soonest. And Powell did say, as he said multiple times, it's data dependent. Perhaps they see a trend downwards in some of their other indicators, that so they think that will sort of you know, filter and trickle through, and that we'll see enough easing in the next few months on inflation that they will be able to start cutting. And to be fair, he does say at some point this year they still think that's the most likely route. I think that there's some risk, frankly, that that could get put off. I also think that they want to cut. And they want to cut before the election. They want to, ideally, my view again, is that they want ideally to go into an election in what would be probably considered some kind of a neutral stance. And I think that's most likely somewhere around 4 to 4.5% right now, as much as you could consider that neutral. So I think that that's probably where the highest odds are of where we're heading. And so again, that cuts could start in Q3, sometime after mid-year, and that we could see you know, probably 3 quarter-point cuts before we get to the election.
I think it was actually in your speech for the silver is the next uranium, but you talked about 30% of U.S. debt maturing in the next year, which is, I don't know if I feel I have a word for that. Can you talk to us about that a little bit as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you're right. That's something that really people sort of need to think about and to sort of stop themselves and give themselves, you know, 10 or 20 seconds to think about the implication of that. U.S. debt is something like $34 trillion right now. And because and Yellen got a lot of criticism for this when rates were really low, that she did not take advantage to renew maturing debt at much longer maturities, you know, to not have this kind of wall coming to them. She did not take advantage of that. A lot of the debt got renewed on very short term. And so now within a year, almost a third of all U.S. debt, so we're talking about just under $9 trillion in bonds, are coming due. And so they're coming, even if they're all renewed on very short term, they're going to have to be renewed at much, much, much higher rates, you know, somewhere close to zero previously to closer to about 4% right now. So that's, you know, if you think of what that means a year out, so let's say you move a year out from now, you've had this $9 trillion of bonds renewed. And even if, as I say, they renew them on a short-term basis, short-term maturities, they keep them that way, a year farther. So that would bring us to, let's say, early 2026 or so, and even before that. So you'd have a huge hit to the U.S. budget in terms of a massive amount of additional interest payments that they're going to be facing on their debt. That's really what it comes down to, is how much this is going to hit and expand and explode interest payments. We're already at about $1 trillion a year. The deficit is just going to rise by that much more through this bond renewals. That's just going to mean more inflation, because there's something else to keep in mind. And that's also one of the slides I had in my recent talk. And that is that foreign holdings of U.S. treasuries are at something like 16-year lows. So they're not interested in holding U.S. debt. That's been falling since 2014. So for a decade, steadily, that's been falling. And the trend is absolutely clearly downward. So who's going to buy all of this? You know, unless, you know, something like Japan would happen, where a lot of the debt is owned internally, which, you know, would take a lot, I think, to reach that kind of level. I think that the Fed's going to have to monetize a lot of that. So the Fed's going to have to turn around, buy a bunch of these treasuries that the U.S. Government ends up having to issue. And that's just going to lead to a lot more inflation. So, you know, if you look at what happened so far in inflation, we've had this massive run up since 2020. It peaked around 9%. I believe it was mid 2022. It's backed off a lot since then. We had a similar way of things playing out in the 1970s when we had stagflation, which economists thought could not exist. So that's when you have a weakening economy, but resiliently high commodities and input prices. I think that's what we're facing for at least the rest of this decade. And in the 1970s, you had three waves of inflation. I think that we're, or most of us are suffering from something called recency bias, where we think that the future is going to look like the recent past. And so I think that most observers are looking at this last spike, this run up in inflation in 2022, and that they think, okay, well, it's one and done. I think that it's going to look more like the 70s. We're going to have these. And in fact, to keep in mind, each of the subsequent run-ups in inflation was higher than the prior one up until we got to something like 18%, I think, in the late 70s. And Volcker was able to step in and quash that by raising rates to crazy amounts. I mean, I am old enough to at least remember people talking about, not my peers, but, you know, my parents and friends' parents talking about their mortgages at 20%. Who thinks that the real estate market could absorb something like that today? Impossible. Even the U.S. debt, the debt to GDP, and that is something that it's one of the charts I have in my book that kind of comes back the most in my mind. The debt to GDP ratio in the 1970s was 35%. Today, it's about 120% in the U.S. So wow. It was much, much easier to deal with 20% interest rates, you know, even for, you know, a question of 6 months or 12 months to quash inflation than it would ever be possible today. It's just an absolute no-go right now. That could never happen. So to me, that means inflation will come roaring back. It'll come roaring back even stronger than before. And I think people need to be prepared for that kind of scenario.
Well, there's a lot of things I like about the idea of the 70s coming back besides inflation. You know, if we have a precious metals bull market, then yes. I guess we can balance it out.
I was just going to say that's where the opportunity is, I think. And that's, you know, as much as what I've talked about so far is, you know, the negative side, the positive side is you've always got, you know, the sort of flip side. And that is absolutely the flip side. Commodities were tremendous in the 70s. I think precious metals were easily, clearly the place to be. And gold, just quick numbers, gold was up 14 times in the 1970s. Silver was up 37 times. So in a decade, and stocks were flat. So, if you think that you're in that kind of environment, I certainly do. That is absolutely the place to be.
Do you think that the election is going to be the catalyst for the precious metals bull market, or do you think we're going to see more of a bull market before and then have a little bit of a pause during election time and see kind of who gets in and what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we've talked about this kind of thing before, and it's kind of an open secret that precious metals do well when, well, here's actually what history tells us, what the research tells us. Gold starts to really do well once we know that the Fed and that central banks have stopped hiking. And so, you know, gold having bottomed, I believe it was around October last year, if memory serves me right, probably somewhere around 1800, and we're at high 2100s right now. So that aligns perfectly. What we also know is that silver follows gold with a lag. And I did the research, and that was also in my recent talk. And so silver, I thought, okay, interesting to know. Gold does well when central banks stop hiking. And so they're at what we call a plateau. And then obviously gold does even better when they actually start cutting. So to follow on that, silver, I looked and saw the last three times the Fed stopped hiking and eventually started cutting. So when silver did the best, when silver started to run, was when the Fed or central banks were about halfway through their cutting cycle. So that could mean, maybe 6 months after they actually start to cut is when silver really starts to take off. And in the last three cycles, silver averaged a 413% gain. So there's some good. Yeah, so do I. I hadn't seen this before, and I thought, I'm curious. So I said, let me do the research, see what happened, and that's what it did. To be fair, yeah. So two of those run-ups were actually a big run-up, and then a small correction, and then a sideways movement. So that's really interesting. One of them, when it actually peaked in 2011 at something like $49, it corrected tremendously over the next few years. It corrected partly after that and then moved sideways and then corrected more. But if you know that this kind of behavior is coming, you can prepare and you can start to take profits after maybe 200-300% gains. That would put us much, much higher in silver prices. And, the juniors especially would just be, would shoot to the moon. There is so little quality in terms of juniors available. I like to say, and it's so well put by guys like Doug Casey, who says, it's like trying to get the contents of Hoover Dam through a garden hose. And, there's not enough to support the capital that would flood into that sector. They would just explode. Yeah, I think if someone's looking for some very, very low downside, but really explosive upside, it's hard to find a more compelling sector.
I 100% agree. Last time we talked to Costco selling out of gold, and now I see that they're actually selling silver. So
yes, I think that's right.
That's an exciting add-on as well.
It is. I actually saw at my own nearby Costco recently that they were selling 10-ounce silver bars and 1-ounce gold coins, maple leafs. So it's coming to a Costco near you.
So let's get a little more into silver. Solar
sure.
Already looks like it's kicking off big for 2024. I've read that the jewelry market is set to have a 6% increase, even with the impact for demand for silver. Is there anything else that you're seeing for the demand on the silver side?
Yeah, so the Silver Institute is forecasting that this year we're going to see solar demand for silver exceed 200 million ounces, probably somewhere around 220 million ounces, still a considerable gain on 2023, which, by the way, was originally forecast at 142 and then revised at 194. So we actually reached 194 million ounces. And the solar demand was forecast at 140 million ounces and revised to 190 million ounces. So here are a few stats I think are really interesting. And this, again, comes from my recent presentation. So I called this slide the Silver 2023 Realities. The overall forecast was that supply would grow by 2%. It was actually eventually revised as a drop of 2% for 2023. So that's a 4% spread. Industrial demand was forecast to grow 4%. Instead, it grew a revised 8%. Again, 4% underestimate. Solar demand, we just talked about, forecast at 140 million ounces, revised at 190 million ounces. That's a big jump. That's 50 million ounces above the 140 that was forecast. That's more than a third more than they had originally expected. The overall supply deficit in the silver market was forecast to be 142 million ounces. That's what came in revised at 194 million ounces. So the last 4 years, there's been huge deficits in the silver market. You know, I've been curious, and I kept getting questions from people. What's happening? How come? How do you have an ongoing deficit? Like, that can only last so long. What's happening, especially since the silver price has been, since 2020, since it ran up in 2020, more or less trading in a sideways range, and it feels and it seems like it's kind of being capped. So I looked at how the silver market is built. Have what I call investment markets. So that's people buying coins and bars, people buying jewelry, and people buying silverware. So for me, I kind of, for understanding purposes, I lump those into investment. Then you have industrial use. So that's a second category. And essentially, those are the two categories. The third one is what I, where the sort of oversupplies when they exist, where that oversupply gets shunted into this third branch. And that's really the futures markets. Futures markets, silver ETFs, and again, some private ownership. So I call that category, the third category, I call it secondary silver inventories. So until about 2020, we went through multiple years of a little bit of oversupply, you know, surplus, and that would end up in the futures markets, and it would end up in ETFs. Since 2020, all of the three major futures markets, so that includes the COMEX, it includes the LBMA, and it includes the Shanghai. Overall, their silver inventories are down about 30 to 40% in the last 3 years, which is huge because we're talking about probably 500-600 million ounces of silver. That's nearly half a year's supply. And then if you look at silver ETFs, their overall worldwide silver ETFs have seen their holdings of silver down about, I'm going to say about probably 300 million ounces as well. Now, what's interesting is that's something we have not seen happen at all since silver ETFs exist. We've not seen ever a consistent drop in inventories in silver ETFs, you know, for the overall inventories that back those silver ETFs. So something's going on. And the conclusion I came to was that because there's so much demand, and I'm going to give you an anecdote after that. I was told by a large silver producer. So the conclusion I came to was that you have these large industrial consumers that are buying long futures contracts on the different exchanges, and probably also buying silver-backed ETFs, and going to the issuer of the ETF and saying, "Okay, I've got X million units of this ETF. I'm entitled to take delivery." So they just tell them, here are my units of the ETF. I'm turning them in, and I want the underlying silver. So please deliver it to this address." And they've been doing the same thing with their long futures contracts and standing for delivery when those contracts mature and saying, "All right, I'm entitled to X million ounces of silver. Here's the address. Please deliver it." Now, that is what I think is going on, and what explains the draining of these different futures markets and ETFs. Now, what I didn't mention is that you've got regular inventories at the exchanges, and then you've got what they call registered inventories. And technically, it's just the registered inventories that are of silver that is silver actually available for delivery. The overall inventory is not all available for delivery. And if you look at just the registered inventories in two of these markets, registered inventories are down 70%. So the deliverable silver is down 70% over 3 years. So, you know, I think we're approaching some kind of a reckoning where someone's not going to get their silver at some point. They may hold a contract like that, And then they'll go to the exchange when it matures, and they'll say, okay, I'd like to take delivery. And the exchange will be stuck. They will say, well, sort of stuck. They'll say, I'm sorry, there's no more silver left for us to deliver. And they'll, if they have to, they'll maybe declare some kind of a force majeure and say, we'll just pay you out in cash. You know, we don't have the silver for you. Sorry. So this is kind of their way out. I know that the market is very tight, because the anecdote that I wanted to share is that this mining executive who produces only silver, very, very high grade silver mine, it produces a couple million ounces of silver a year, sells to China, sells to the West, and says that China in particular is very, very anxious to get their silver deliveries from them, to the point where they're saying, all right, we're prepared to pay you a couple of weeks in advance, and we're prepared to pay you $3 above spot to get the silver. They really, absolutely, desperately want it. And I believe that story totally, because of what I see that's going on in the futures and ETF markets.
I feel like I should run to Costco right now and go buy some silver.
Well, apparently they do have amongst the best deals. So, so that wouldn't be a good place to get it.
When we're talking about silver, and you just mentioned one of the producers, when do you think we seem to be like on this disconnect here with the markets? Yeah. Of, you see gold run and silver, you know, has had its runs, but it's not really translating into the juniors so far that we've seen. It feels like we're on a teeter-totter of, you know, all this sideline money and the juniors, and someone needs to switch sides and change the balance here. What do you think will be a catalyst to that we start to see that trickle-down effect into the markets for the juniors?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that it's going to be the price first. We are seeing, you know, because I do follow this obviously very closely, sometimes almost minute by minute, but we do see already some of the majors and some of the sort of mid-tiers have seen a big improvement in their share price just in the matter of the last couple of weeks. So that is happening. I do see, I'm going to say, probably the best quality name juniors have also seen amongst the biggest bumps. But in terms of getting that to trickle down and spread across the entire space, we're going to need to see, I think it's going to be even better gold, which will translate into a lot better silver prices, and that's going to bleed easily into the different categories of silver, you know, silver companies, from the majors to the mid tiers to the juniors. So if I had to roughly guess some kind of a timeline, I mean, I do think that we're going to see considerably higher silver prices by like the third quarter of this year, maybe as high as 26, 28. I think that's going to lead to much higher numbers. So I'd say somewhere around maybe 9 to 12 months out, we could see plenty of the names that the better names have doubled by then. It would not surprise me at all. You know, many of them are down 60, 70, 80% over the last 2 years. So it's not unrealistic by any means to see that kind of a gain. And there'd be a lot of juice left. So I'm very bullish.
Last time we spoke, you mentioned Bolivia. And it's funny because pretty much every conference and every conversation I've gone to now is Bolivia, Bolivia. And
is that right?
that jurisdiction seems to be opening up. It seems to be the hot topic. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that, as we saw Peru and Mexico down on the supply side last year. Do you think, obviously with New Pacific and some of the bigger players moving into Bolivia, that's one of the mm-hmm. jurisdictions that we should definitely be paying attention to for silver?
Yes, I do think so. I mean, I think that here's how I see it. And I, you know, I kind of checked my conclusion with people in the space. And my conclusion about Bolivia was that At first, I stayed away for a couple of years, to be perfectly honest. And then when I started to see quality names operating there and the circumstances around them, I dug deeper. And so, and then eventually I came to the conclusion that Bolivia is where, in some ways, parts of Chile, parts of Peru, and maybe even parts of Colombia today are at. I think Bolivia was there 15 years ago. And I think they're saying, you know what, we've tried all this. It doesn't work. and you know, mining's too important to us, and let's just become more pragmatic about it. And I think really that's what it is. They've reached, you know, the pragmatic, practical conclusion earlier because they've tried all that stuff and it did not work. So they've become a lot more mining friendly. And so you've got some big names. You've got Pan American that's been operating a mine there for, I think it's 20 plus years, very successfully, very smoothly. And then you've got New Pacific, which has connections to Pan American. And so I believe that's a big help to New Pacific because of the tie-in with Pan American and the good relations Pan American has already. And then you've got a smaller player, Carche Silver, which is very, very early stage, but I think is looking quite interesting. They are connected to a company called Iloro, and Iloro has a big project called Isca Isca. It's more base metals, but it's nearby, and they own part of Carche Silver. Carche has been careful to get properties that were originally owned on private land, and so it makes things much, much easier to pursue, to permit, to go through exploration and to advance. And so there are certain ways, and you know, if you are connected to the right people and you have sufficient experience in Bolivia, then there are ways to you know, sort of, I'm going to say, fast track your projects. That allows you to pick the better project that you can own in a more favorable way and therefore advance more easily and more quickly. And so, again, it's not the easiest jurisdiction, but I think that because of its history, it's been so underexplored, certainly has not seen much modern exploration, has not seen much consistent exploration. And so the potential there is really, I think, pretty big. I think Bolivia is something like number six in the world for silver, as a silver supplier. I think it could climb up ranking or two over the next decade or two, just through, as I say, you know, pursuing some really attractive opportunities. There are some private operators there as well. Some really, how can I put it? Some really savvy money is involved in some privately run mines, and I think they're going to have some really big success there. Also on the silver side, that will help. Hopefully those become investable on the public side as well, but I think they're going to help bring a lot of silver to market, and that's badly needed because there was an interesting bit of research by Bank of America. They surveyed the 13 largest primary silver miners globally and asked them where they thought mine supply was going to be going out the next few years. And on average, they said it was going to be flat, which is kind of shocking when you see the growth in demand for silver and the tightness of the market. Silver supply from mining peaked in 2016 at 900 million ounces. We're right around 800 million ounces today. So that's almost 10% lower, and the 13 largest producers of silver, or I should say primary producers of silver, don't see any growth in silver supply, mine supply. So that's very telling, and that tells me that the market's going to remain very tight, and that is very supportive of higher prices.
Wow, well, that definitely sold me on doing some more due diligence on Bolivia.
Yeah.
I was down at Mines and Money, and I got to meet Black Rock Silver and Sumitomo. Can you just talk to us quickly about two of those companies as well?
Yes, those are two of my higher conviction ones, actually, and they are neighbors. They're neighbors in Nevada. So Black Rock has quite well-known deposit that is over 100 million ounces of very high-grade silver. I believe it's over 500 grams per ton of silver equivalent. So the equivalency is mostly gold. So I have no problem when the other metal is gold. I do like to see a lot of silver, obviously, but so that's really good. They are continuing to advance that project. They've grown it tremendously since they've owned it, going back about just under 4 years, back around 2019 or 2020. And so that is on the western side of the district. So that's a really interesting one. I think that that's when the larger players start to get interested, and at 100 million ounces and really high grade, and in a fantastic jurisdiction and a tremendous infrastructure. I mean, they're almost literally off the highway. I think you can, within almost minutes drive to like a Burger King or something. It's incredible how easily you can get to this place. And then you've got Suma, who is their immediate neighbor, the east side, right across the highway. So they are the eastern portion of the Tonopah district. They do not have a resource yet, but they have what I consider two flagship projects. So one of them is the East Tonopah portion, which they call the Hughes Project, which actually was part of it was owned by Howard Hughes going back decades. Their second flagship is called Mogollon, which is in New Mexico. And they are getting amazing high-grade results in both of these. In the at the Hughes Project in Tonopah East, they've stepped out a matter of kilometers from where the historic intercepts are, and they've found high-grade silver over multiple meters. So between that and the New Mexico project, which is consistently hitting very high grades. This is an old mining district that has a lot of existing workings. And so they're able to, at least ultimately, they'll do some underground drilling and they do some above ground drilling. But they are getting some really, again, wide intercepts of really high grades of silver. And between the two projects, I think easily at some point, Suma is going to reach probably somewhere around 50 million ounces of silver or silver equivalent in each of those, and they could easily become some kind of an equivalency to Black Rock. There's even some potential upside where someone will step in at some point and maybe try to consolidate the Black Rock West Tonopah West project together with Suma's Tonopah East, the Hughes project. Because there's a lot of synergies to be had right there. So certainly some interesting things happening and some really strong potential in that area. Fantastic jurisdiction to be working.
Just for listeners out there, how many silver juniors do you cover in your newsletter? And how many are they missing out that they should sign up for?
Yeah, so silver juniors, right around 15 or so at least. I'm going to include in there sort of some of the juniors that are actually producing and developing at the same time. Some of them are only working towards development, but they have very, very big projects. So if you count those, then yes, on the order of about 15. So some lots of very, very high quality names in terms of their deposits, their teams that are running the show, and the potential, and you know, it's just a sign of the times. A handful have performed really well, and the bulk have been very challenged. You know, price wise, they've sold off along with silver, and so they're just more compelling than ever. Tremendous opportunities, and I think that. It's, again, like I said before, you'd be hard pressed to find a more compelling sector in terms of minimized downside risk and almost unlimited upside potential.
Well, I mean, you picked Hercules last time, so I think investors should definitely check it out. Peter, what's your forecast for the spring and coming into summer? What do you think is going to happen for silver and for the markets out there?
I'm going to be honest. I think that, you know, we've had such a strong run in gold and silver, and I'm talking about gold because I feel that silver will ultimately follow it. I would not be surprised to see either a bit of a pullback in gold, because it kind of needs to digest this run over the last, this tremendous run, in fact, over the last week and a half or so, almost 2 weeks, where it's been hitting all-time highs, which is just tremendous. And it just feels like no one's paying attention. I mean, we are, because we follow this sector, but you're not hearing about any of this on mainstream media. So for all intents and purposes, nobody knows, and nobody is realizing this. I think that it could be due for, you know, either a sideways movement to digest the gains or even somewhat of a pullback. That would not surprise me. I'd expect the same kind of behavior in silver. So watch perhaps for in the very near term, I'm talking the next sort of week or two, to see a bit of a dialing back in the prices of the metals as well as the equities. And if you're really interested in this sector, I believe that is a tremendous time to start nibbling, start working your way into these positions. I'd like to say that, you know, it makes sense to average in. Decide how much, what you like, how much you want to allocate to a given name. And then let's say it's as simple as $1,000. You know, I would suggest allocate maybe a third of that and do it over a span of weeks or months and be tactical about it. Follow those names, watch them very closely. There's nothing like putting a few dollars into a name to have you watch it like a hawk. And once you've made that even small commitment, I guarantee you, you probably will watch that stock every day. And if you see that it has pulled back from your original or your first commitment, your first tranche, then you may want and sort of pull back and sort of stabilize. That may be your cue to making a second tranche, a second commitment, and follow it closely. And if it starts to move up gradually and not seem to want to back off, you may want to start then making your third, buying your third tranche of it, and then watch it carefully. You know, if you're lucky enough to get a 50 or 100% gain in it, these things can come very quickly. In some cases, do not hesitate to take, you know, take some profits, especially if you get a double, take profits. Play with the house's money, as I like to call it. All your risk is off the table, and then you can ride that thing to wherever it goes, and you won't feel like you've got anything to lose. Especially in the juniors, you wanna be as tactical as you can about playing that space.
Well, I hope we all find some doubles this year. That would be fantastic. Where can we find you next? Where can investors see you at the next conference? I know we say this every time, but give them your newsletter and where to find your book.
So I will actually be at the Swiss Mining Institute's conference, which is on the 20th and 21st of March in Zurich. So I'll be speaking there and presenting there. And after that, I believe the next one would be at the Metals Investor Forum in May in Vancouver. That, I believe, is the 10th and 11th of May. And so people can follow me on an almost daily basis. I mean, they can find my newsletter at silverstockinvestor.com. I have The Great Silver Bull, which the book I published, which you mentioned at the outset, which is available on Amazon, The Great Silver Bull. And finally, I'm pretty active on Twitter, so you can follow me there. It's at Peter_Kraut, K-R-A-U-T-H. And I'm on LinkedIn as well, Peter Kraut. So those are the best ways.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for today, Peter, and I look forward to the next one.
Kelly, thank you, and as always, my pleasure.
Well, that does it for today's Exploring Mining podcast. If you'd like to be a guest or sponsor for this podcast, please contact investorideas.com. Investorideas.com reminds all listeners to read our disclaimers and disclosures on the investorideas.com website. All investment involves risk, and this podcast is not meant to be an endorsement to buy or sell securities or products. To hear more podcasts, you can go to investorideas.com/audio. And a reminder, you can also hear our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play Music, iHeart.com, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, and SoundCloud.